It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Saturday, November 26, 2022. I'm Ryan Schmelz. Union workers representing America's rail industry could go on strike in the coming weeks, a move that some experts say would be devastating to the U.S. economy. After two of the major unions rejected a recent contract, what comes next in the negotiations to get a deal done between the unions and rail companies, and could the government step in?
It looks, the closer we get to that December 5th or December 9th date, it looks like we will get a strike the closer we get to that point.
I'm Jared Halpert. Former President Trump is again the focus of a special counsel's investigation.
Based on recent developments, including the former president's announcement that he is a candidate for president in the next election.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
Back in September, President Biden took to the podium in the Rose Garden to celebrate a deal struck between railroad companies and the unions representing over 100,000 employees. President Biden called the deal a win for both sides. But a few months later, while the majority of unions voted to ratify the contract, one-third, including the nation's largest rail union, voted to ultimately turn down the deal, which could ultimately affect not just freight trains, but some Amtrak and commuter lines. The news adds new concerns as we head into the holidays, with a new deadline of December 8th.
Well, should the strike happen, it could have a profound impact on the economy because 27% of freight comes on rail, and you just can't make up that volume, that difference with trucks.
Edward Lawrence is a White House correspondent with the Fox Business Network.
One, we have a truck shortage, a trucker shortage, so that would push the price up because you'd have not enough trucks to be able to carry all of the stuff that is currently carried on rail. And then you could have shortages on the other side of that where, you know, the companies, stores can't get enough of what they need as customers are buying. And again, that shortage will then put inflationary pressures up. It could cost the economy at the bottom line $2 billion a day should it happen. And we'll circle the date December 5th. That's when the first rail union could first go on strike. Four unions have voted no on this contract. The other three unions, December 9th is the date, the first date that they could go. So the first union may push their strike back to December 9th so everybody goes at the same time. Now, there are talks ongoing between the unions and the rail companies trying to bridge this impasse. But again, December 5th, December 9th, that's going to be a big week for the U.S. economy.
And you mentioned the talks between the unions and the companies. The Biden administration yesterday was asked about, or the press secretary was asked about his involvement in the negotiations. Obviously, pretty involved last time having the Labor Department involved and also having the Rose Garden speech after a deal was struck. You know, what's our gauge about what type of involvement he has this time around?
Yeah, Karine Jean-Pierre was very vague about the direct involvement. Now, we do know the president is being briefed on how things are going. There is some conversation related to the administration and the unions as well as the rail companies, but it seems since the midterm elections, the administration is sort of taking a back seat. And the line has been from the White House press secretary in all of the statements we've seen that the parties need to work this out. So it seems like they're more hands-off since the midterm elections. Before the midterm elections, there was direct involvement. In fact, in order to get that tentative agreement, the labor secretary basically locked all the parties in a room, wouldn't let them leave until something like 2-3 in the morning till they had an agreement. So that was extreme direct involvement. We're not getting that kind or that level of involvement since the midterm elections. So we're going to see what happens. You know, it's interesting to note that the president here can't force the unions to sign onto the contract. Congress can under the Rail Act. It's a lame duck session, so we'll have to see what happens. But they've only got about 2 weeks if Congress needs to step in and do something.
Right, and with congressional intervention and that possibility, we've seen some members of the retail industry asking for Congress to take action. What are the chances that Congress does take action, and how could that look?
Yeah, well, and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has sent a letter to congressional members urging them to get involved in this process. You know, it's hard to get Congress to decide on anything nowadays, so I think it's going to be a very tough sell if you're going to try and bank your hopes on Congress heading off a strike. That's the reason a number of the parties are getting together. There's a lot of pressure from outside groups on the unions as well as the rail companies to come to some sort of agreement. The American Chemistry Council has said that if there is a prolonged strike, it could impact and cut 700,000 jobs in the chemical industry. So that's because all the liquids and chemicals that are carried on freight, on trains that go to the various products. So this strike could have a ripple effect throughout the economy, not just on products, but also real impact on jobs.
And based off what we've been talking about, it seems like most everyone involved who could be impacted thinks the best solution here would just be if these both sides are able to come to an agreement. Do we have an idea how close they are or how far apart they are right now?
So as we understand it, the main sticking point is basically time off, paid time off, sick leave, as well as non-paid time off. One of the union leaders that we spoke with, who actually his union signed on to the tentative agreement, but he was saying basically many of the engineers and conductors, for example, have no scheduled days off. That's just the way it has been set up in terms of how their schedule works. And he claims that when employees get sick, if they get COVID or they need to take time off, for their families, they get a strike against them, and in some cases, the attendance points, because of those attendance points, many employees have been fired by the railroads. So the main sticking point is because, not the salaries, but it's this paid leave or unpaid leave that they would like to get inside the contract, because the salary is there. I mean, you've got a 14.1% raise immediately and a 24% raise by 2024. It pushes the average salary for a rail worker under this tentative agreement to $160,000 a year. Now, put that in perspective, the average construction worker makes $84,000 a year, and the average warehouse worker makes $83,000 a year. So this contract pushes that double what those skilled jobs are doing.
And do we have an idea of how willing the rail companies are to overhaul the sick paid or time off policy at all?
This negotiation started 3.5 years ago, so that tells you how willing both parties are to move. It's a slog. It's a very slow go trying to get to this. It looks, the closer we get to that December 5th or December 9th date, it looks like we will get a strike. The closer we get to that point, we will just have to wait and see see how hard and how these negotiations play out.
And is there also a possibility that they could potentially move the strike date back? Is that possible?
Yes. Absolutely. This is just the first possible date that there could be a strike. If it looks like there's progress, the unions may decide, hey, we look like we're making progress on this. There might be something that could be coming, so we can push those dates back. These dates are not set in stone. These are just the first possible dates that there could be a strike. You give out these dates to folks who are listening. If you're getting Christmas presents, you know, order them now, just in case, because if there is a strike and it's closer to Christmas, the goods that you want might not necessarily be on the shelves in the stores because they can't get to the stores themselves from the ports.
All right, and we're recording this on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And I think one thing that might be interesting to point out here is, you know, I believe the last strike was in 1992, correct?
I believe that's right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, obviously the economy changes a lot in 20 years. And I think one thing that might be different this time around is, you know, the timing of this really seems like it might not be ideal whatsoever because, you know, we're coming out of a pandemic. We have inflation that's already a massive issue on our economy, but we also have supply chains that have been disrupted. And a lot of that has to do with the pandemic here. So could you say that the timing of this really just hasn't been ideal at all?
Not at all. In fact, you've got these businesses, companies that are relying on products, trying to survive. Many small businesses had trouble getting stuff to their stores because you talk about the supply chain issues through COVID, and they're trying to come out of COVID and make a profit and just survive as a store. So therefore, they need to have this stuff on the shelves. This is literally the worst possible time this could happen, just because of where the Christmas shopping or the holiday shopping season is. And that is a huge boost. That season is a huge boost for companies and businesses in order to sell their products to consumers. And the consumers drive 70% of the market, the consumer spending does. So they need, and we're already hearing from experts that the consumer spending will be less this year because of the economy and the way it is. So these companies critically need the stuff for the shelves so they can at least sell what they have in order to try and make a profit and stay afloat. And then that means jobs. You know, it all has a ripple effect.
Right. And I think, too, one thing to point out might be that, you know, online ordering has become extremely popular. You know, people aren't going to retail stores the way they used to. Do you think the fact that so many of us are reliant on online sales and online shipping, it might be another problem added to this?
Well, of course. I mean, and the online, you know, when you buy something online, that it still comes on a train. You know, the product you buy generally goes to a port. That port then ships it to possibly a rail car. That rail car ships it to a warehouse, where then it gets on a truck and goes off to the various warehouses or goes to your door. So at some point in the chain, there's a train that's involved in that process. And if that train is not in that process, you've got a problem. That's another break in the supply chain and more pressure on the trucking system, which is already overloaded, as we've seen.
And I think as we come to the end of this, you know, what are the chances as we record this on Wednesday that either the current contract that has been agreed to by several of the unions gets amended to get the other four on board, or they just kind of throw this out and start from scratch?
Well, I have not heard that anybody is starting from scratch. So I think that what's happening now is the four unions that have said no to this are working within the framework of the tentative agreement that they have. Now, there may be additions to it, but at this point, they're not scrapping it and starting over again, is what I understand. You know, to put a percentage on it, your guess is as good as mine. It's just really bad timing for the economy and the consumer.
That's Edward Lawrence from the Fox Business Network. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ryan.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Anyone who has followed news in Washington the last few years is familiar with the term special counsel. Robert Mueller's special counsel probe into Russian election interference dominated the Trump presidency. Former President Trump's Attorney General Bill Barr named another special counsel, John Durham, to investigate the origins of the Russia investigation. Durham's work continues to this day. This week, another special counsel was ordered by Attorney General Merrick Garland.
Based on recent developments, including the former president's announcement that he is a candidate for president in the next election, and the sitting president's stated intention to be a candidate as well, I have concluded that it is in the public interest to appoint a special counsel.
Jack Smith, a longtime federal prosecutor, will now oversee two separate investigations involving former President Trump, looking into the role the former president had in events surrounding the January 6th Capitol riot and the potential mishandling of classified material seized by the FBI at his Mar-a-Lago estate. Jake Gibson covers the Justice Department for Fox News, is deeply sourced in the department, so I invited him to answer questions about what this new special counsel could mean for those two investigations and how independent the role is.
Special counsel is supposed to be someone who is looked at as someone who's ultimately independent, that, you know, it gives an attorney general cover, say, I'm not going to be involved in any politics. So basically, what a special counsel is designed to keep politics out of this, so that it's an independent party. So when you appoint a special counsel, basically you're saying this is something that is extraordinary, and that we want to assure the American public that the Department of Justice, the administration, and especially the Department of Justice in power, is not in any way putting its finger on the scales of justice here. So that's why you appoint one of the, right? So that's why they appointed, they've appointed them in the past, you know, with such as Mueller, the Mueller investigation, and then Barr appointed Durham, and you can go all the way back to Ken Starr.
Before that, I mean, There was one during the Nixon administration, right?
Right. So they historically the point is to keep politics out of the conversation and to give the American public some assurance, you know, and some confidence that this is not that we are taking this on the up and up. We are going to apply the law equally to both sides.
And so in this case, it seemed to me that the timing of saying, all right, we're going to have a special counsel for these two ongoing investigations. The Justice Department has been looking into what, if any, role former President Trump played as it relates to January 6th and the transition of power, in addition to, obviously, the Mar-a-Lago documents, right? So those are sort of the two investigations that were underway.
Yeah, I mean, on the federal side, obviously, yeah, there are some other investigations going on in states in New York and Georgia, but on the federal side, the main two that we know about are the Mar-a-Lago investigation, where, you know, President Trump had thousands of documents were seized from the former president's residence at Mar-a-Lago. We now have this new special counsel, a guy named Jack Smith, who I've been told from multiple sources, a no-nonsense prosecutor, you know, he's coming from The Hague, where he's been prosecuting war crimes committed in Kosovo. So there's this new special counsel is going to oversee the ongoing investigation into the documents at Mar-a-Lago. But separately, as you said, there's also the investigation going on to key aspects of what happened on January 6th. This is more about specifically, did Trump or others close to him somehow direct any of this, or were they complicit?
Is the timing of naming a special counsel or the decision to name a special counsel directly related to the former president announcing he is running for office again?
Well, I mean, the timing sure is curious. You know, there's no way for me to know because the attorney general won't talk to me about it. But
or anybody, know, but, right?
Right. Or anybody else. But yes, your point is a good one. You know, the former president announces a third presidential run, and less than a week later, I believe, we have the announcement of a special counsel being appointed by Attorney General Merrick Garland, who went to great pains during a statement that he gave at the Department of Justice. I was there for that. Interestingly, he did not take any questions, but he gave a statement where he said that he just thought this was the right thing to do. That, you know, if you have a former president running who is under investigation, and you have a current president who is involved in the next election, that we need a special counsel. Ultimately, Garland was saying, I want no part of this. I don't want to be in the middle of this.
So that was what I was going to ask, right? So does this mean that if there were a decision made whether to or not to prosecute Donald Trump, that decision is made now entirely by the special counsel? In other words, is Merrick Garland now completely removed from any prosecution decision as it relates to former President Trump?
Attorney General Merrick Garland, if he were here with us, I believe would say, yes, I'll have nothing to do with those decisions. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there'd be other people that say, well, come on, let's get serious. He's going to be briefed on this stuff and he's going to have a role. We don't really know. But by the letter of the law, by the letter of the regulation of the attorney of the special counsel and the Department of Justice regulations, you know, he answers to the attorney general in the sense that if he were to submit a report at the end, as special counsel Durham will on the origins of the Russia investigation, he will submit a report at the end. We have been told by many sources, and he will submit that report to Attorney General Garland. And Attorney General Garland will then make a decision about how much of that report to release to the American public. He has said he'd like to release as much as he can. Some of it will have to do with, you know, whether some of the information is privileged. Now, back to the matter at hand. Special Counsel Smith, by the letter of the regulation, he should be the one making decisions on if there will be prosecutions made out of his office against Donald Trump or people close to Donald Trump. Other people who might be more cynical might say, well, of course, Attorney General Garland is going to know about this or might even be involved. I just don't know. But he's telling us that he will not be. That the only thing he'll be involved in is to continue to make sure that that office receives the budget that it receives to stay open, which is what he's done with Special Counsel Durham. You know, he has He has made sure and taken great pains to tell us he still has a budget, and I approve his budget, and that's all I do.
Can Special Counsel Smith be fired by anybody? And is there, within the statute or within the way that it was set up, is there a deadline for completion of his work?
There's no deadline, and these things go on forever. I mean, we're now entering like the third year of Durham, right? And there are some indications that Durham might be wrapping up. It kind of seems like that, although we don't know for sure. But it's been going on for quite a while. And how long did Mueller's office, continue work on that report, right? And the prosecutions out of that office. These things tend to go on for a couple, if not a few years. As far as can anyone fire him, I think President Trump, from if you believe the reporting, pushed the envelope on that pretty hard in trying to see if he could fire Robert Mueller, but that didn't work out, and he was unable to do that. So I don't know. You know, I think that the Attorney General would say no, he can't be fired. He continues his investigation. But I think ultimately, if there were some extenuating circumstance, if you found that a special counsel was breaking the law, I'm sure that there is a provision in the regs where the Attorney General could fire him. But basically, he's supposed to be completely independent and be able to follow the facts where they lead him and take him or her to a prosecution eventually, potentially.
I'll finish with this to that point. How far afield are these two investigations on their own? So obviously these were being conducted by U.S. attorneys, by you know, the FBI, within the Justice Department. The special counsel is going to come in now, oversee all of these. You know, how far along are they? And is there sort of a reset now? Does Smith come in and say, listen, I want to start from scratch? Because some of these have gone to like grand jury phases, have they not?
They are, yes. I think that both of them are in grand jury phases. And I think that that from what we've heard, that Smith has told people, just continue your work. And he hasn't even arrived in the U.S. yet. He's still at The Hague. And supposedly he's some kind of like, you know, Iron Man triathlete, and he got injured recently and had a knee surgery. So he wasn't at the Department of Justice when his appointment was announced, and I don't think he's in the U.S. yet. I assume he'll be here, you know, in the coming weeks. But these investigations are pretty far along. I mean, you know, the Department of Justice, the U.S. government, has had these thousands of documents from Mar-a-Lago for quite a long time now, and then the special master took the lion's share of them, but from what we can tell, not the really important ones. Mm-hmm. Those 100 or so documents that, you know, if you believe other outlets' reportings, can include even nuclear secrets. Those have been in the possession of the Department of Justice and still are. And so that investigation is moving along. And then we know that there's been a grand jury that has been interviewing people about the events that led up to January 6th. And if you believe some of the reports we've heard, and they're specifically asking about, you know, President Trump's actions and those close to him in the days and hours leading up to the attack on the Capitol. And we should learn that in the next few months. We really should. This has been going on, in my opinion, too long.
Jake Gibson, always the insight into the Justice Department. Appreciate the explainer again. I know you and I have talked a lot about special counsels, and here we are again, and we'll continue to have these talks. Appreciate it as always.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Very nice of you.
Tomorrow on the Fox News Rundown from Washington, House Republicans are promising a new focus on oversight, putting President Biden's family and the Homeland Security Secretary on notice. Democrat-aligned groups are preparing for a rapid response. Jessica Rosenthal talks with strategists from both sides about the hearings ahead. And there is bad blood between Ticketmaster and Taylor Swift fans. Congress is getting involved in a new round of antitrust investigations. I'll speak with a former chairman of the Federal Trade Commission about it. Until then, I'm Jared Halpern. Thanks for listening to the Fox News Rundown from Washington.
please rate and review this podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.